Welcome to the Public Domain Podcast. This week we'll be continuing with The Master of the World by Jules Verne, and we'll be doing chapters 7, A Third Machine, 8, At Any Cost, and 9, The Second Letter. If you missed the earlier podcast of this novel, you could download them at publicdomainpodcast.blogspot.com. Chapter 7, A Third Machine. I confess that at first this letter dumbfounded me. O's and ah's slipped from my open mouth. The old servant stared at me, not knowing what to think. "Oh, sir, is it bad news?" I answered, for I kept few secrets from this faithful soul, by reading her the letter from end to end. She listened with much anxiety. "A joke, without doubt," said I, shrugging my shoulders. "Well," returned my superstitious handmaid, "if it isn't from the devil, it's from the devil's country, anyway." Left alone, I again went over this unexpected letter. Reflection inclined me yet more strongly to believe that it was the work of a practical joker. My adventure was well known. The newspapers had given it in full detail. Some satirists, such as exist even in America, must have written this threatening letter to mock me. To assume, on the other hand, that the Eyrie really served as a refuge of a band of criminals seemed absurd. If they feared that the police would discover their retreat, surely they would not have been so foolish as to have forced attention upon themselves. Their chief security would lie in keeping their presence there unknown. They must have realized that such a challenge from them would only arouse the police to renewed activity. Dynamite or melanite would soon open entrance to their fortress. Moreover, how could these men have, themselves, gained entrance into the Eyrie unless there existed a passage which we had failed to discover? Assuredly, the letter came from a jester or a madman, and I need not worry over it, nor even consider it. Hence, though for an instant I had thought of showing this letter to Mr. Ward, I decided not to do so. Surely he would attach no importance to it. However, I did not destroy it, but locked it in my desk for safe keeping. If more letters came of the same kind, and with the same initials, I would attach as little weight to them as to this. Several days passed quietly. There was nothing to lead me to expect that I should soon quit Washington, though in my line of duty one is never certain of the morrow. At any moment I might be sent speeding from Oregon to Florida, from Maine to Texas, and this unpleasant thought haunted me frequently if my next mission were no more successful than that to the Great Eyrie. I might as well give up and hand in my resignation from the force. Of the mysterious chauffeur, or chauffeurs, nothing more was heard. I knew that our own government agents, as well as foreign ones, were keeping keen watch over all the roads and rivers, all the lakes and the coast of America. Of course, the size of the country made any close supervision impossible, but these twin inventors had not before chosen secluded and unfrequented spots in which to appear. The main highway of Wisconsin on a great race day, the harbor of Boston, incessantly crossed by thousands of boats, these were hardly what would be called hiding places. If the daring driver had not perished, of which there was always strong probability, then he must have left America. Perhaps he was in the waters of the old world, or else resting in some retreat known only to himself, and in that case... "Ah," I repeated to myself many times, "for such a retreat, as secret as inaccessible, this fantastic personage could not find one better than the Great Eyrie. But, of course, a boat could not get there, any more than an automobile. Only high-flying birds of prey, eagles or condors, could find refuge there." The 19th of June I was going to the police bureau, when, on leaving my house, I noticed two men who looked at me with a certain keenness. Not knowing them, I took no notice, and if my attention was drawn to the matter, it was because my servant spoke of it when I returned. "For some days," she said, "she had noticed that two men seemed to be spying upon me in the street. They stood constantly, perhaps 100 steps from my house, and she suspected that they followed me each time I went up the street." "You are sure?" I asked. "Yes, sir, and no longer ago than yesterday, when you came into the house, these men came slipping along in your footsteps, and then went away as soon as the door was shut behind you." "You must be mistaken." "I am not, sir." "And if you met these two men, you would know them."
"I would."
"Good," I cried, laughing. "I see you have the very spirit for it, detective. I must engage you as a member of our force." Joke if you like, sir, but I have still two good eyes, and I don't need spectacles to recognize people. Someone is spying on you, that's certain, and you should put some of your men to track them in turn. All right, I promise to do so, I said, to satisfy her. And when my men get after them, we shall soon know what these mysterious fellows want of me. In truth, I did not take the good soul's excited announcement very seriously. I added, however, when I go out, I will watch the people round me with great care. That will be best, sir. My poor old housekeeper was always frightening herself at nothing. If I see them again, she added, I will warn you before you set foot out of doors. Agreed. And I broke off the conversation, knowing well that if I allowed her to run on, she would end by being sure that Beelzebub himself and one of his chief attendants were at my heels. The two following days there was certainly no one spying on me, either at my exits or entrances, so I concluded my old servant had made much of nothing as usual. But on the morning of the 22nd of June, after rushing upstairs as rapidly as her age would permit, the devoted old soul burst into my room and in a half-whisper gasped, "Sir, sir, what is it?" "They're here!" "Who?" I queried, my mind on anything but the web she had been spinning about me. "The two spies!" "Ah, those wonderful spies!" "Themselves, in the street, right in front of our windows, watching the house, waiting for you to go out." I went to the window, and raising just an edge of the shade, so as not to give any warning, I saw two men on the pavement. They were rather fine-looking men, broad-shouldered and vigorous, aged somewhat under 40, dressed in the ordinary fashion of the day, with slouched hats, heavy woolen suits, stout walking shoes, and sticks in hand. Undoubtedly, they were staring persistently at my apparently unwatchful house. Then, having exchanged a few words, they strolled off a little way and returned again. "Are you sure these are the same men you saw before?" "Yes, sir." Evidently, I could no longer dismiss her warning as an hallucination, and I promised myself to clear up the matter. As to following the men myself, I was presumably too well known to them. To address them directly would probably be of no use. But that very day, one of our best men should be put on watch, and if the spies returned on the morrow, they should be tracked in their turn and watched until their identity was established. At the moment, they were waiting to follow me to police headquarters, for it was there that I was bound, as usual. If they accompanied me, I might be able to offer them a hospitality for which they would scarce thank me. I took my hat, and while the housekeeper remained peeping from behind the window, I went downstairs, opened the door, and stepped into the street. The two men were no longer there. Despite all my watchfulness, that day I saw no more of them as I passed along the streets. From that time on, indeed, neither my old servant nor I saw them again before the house, nor did I encounter them elsewhere. Their appearance, however, was stamped upon my memory. I would not forget them. Perhaps, after all, admitting that I had been the object of their espionage, they had been mistaken in my identity. Having obtained a good look at me, they now followed me no more. So in the end, I came to regard this matter as of no more importance than the letter of the initials, M.O.W. Then, on the 24th of June, there came a new event, to further stimulate both my interest and that of the general public in the previous mysteries of the automobile and the boat. The Washington Evening Star published the following account, which was next morning copied by every paper in the country. Lake Kirdall, in Kansas, 40 miles west of Topeka, is little known. It deserves wider knowledge, and doubtless will have it hereafter, for attention is now drawn to it in a very remarkable way. This lake, deep among the mountains, appears to have no outlet. What it loses by evaporation, it regains from the little neighboring streamlets and the heavy rains. Lake Kirdall covers about 75 square miles, and its level is but slightly below that of the heights which surround it. Shut in among the mountains, it can be reached only by narrow and rocky gorges. Several villages, however, have sprung up upon its banks. It is full of fish, and fishing boats cover its waters. Lake Kirdall is in many places 50 feet deep close to shore. Sharp, pointed rocks form the edges of this huge basin. Its surges, roused by high winds, beat upon its banks with fury, and the houses near at hand are often deluged with spray, as if with the downpour of a hurricane. The lake, already deep at the edge, becomes yet deeper toward the center, where in some places soundings show over 300 feet of water. The fishing industry supports a population of several thousands, and there are several hundred fishing boats in addition to the dozen or so of little steamers which serve the traffic of the lake. Beyond the circle of the mountains lie the railroads which transport the products of the fishing industry throughout Kansas and the neighboring states. The account of Lake Kirdall is necessary for the understanding of the remarkable facts which we are about to report, and this is what the Evening Star then reported in its startling article. For some time past, the fishermen have noticed a strange upheaval in the waters of the lake. Sometimes it rises as if a wave surged up from its depths. Even in perfectly calm weather, when there is no wind whatever, this upheaval sometimes arises in a mass of foam. Tossed about by violent waves and unaccountable currents, boats have been swept beyond all control. Sometimes they have been dashed one against another, and serious damage has resulted. This confusion of the waters evidently has its origin somewhere in the depths of the lake, and various explanations have been offered to account for it. At first, it was suggested that the trouble was due to seismic forces, to some volcanic action beneath the lake, but this hypothesis had to be rejected when it was recognized that the disturbance was not confined to one locality, but spread itself over the entire surface of the lake, either at one part or another, in the center or along the edges, traveling along almost in a regular line and in a way to exclude entirely all idea of earthquake or volcanic action. Another hypothesis suggested that it was a marine monster who thus upheaved the waters. But unless the beast had been born in the lake and had there grown to its gigantic proportions unsuspected, which was scarce possible, he must have come there from outside. Lake Kirdall, however, has no connection with any other waters. If this lake were situated near any of the oceans, there might be subterranean canals, but in the center of America, and at the height of some thousands of feet above sea level, this is not possible. In short, here is another riddle not easy to solve, and it is much easier to point out the impossibility of false explanations than to discover the true one. Is it possible that a submarine boat is being experimented with beneath the lake? Such boats are no longer impossible today. Some years ago at Bridgeport, Connecticut, there was launched a boat, the Protector, which could go on the water, under the water, and also upon land. Built by an inventor named Lake, supplied with two motors, an electric one of 75 horsepower and a gasoline one of 250 horsepower, it was also provided with wheels a yard in diameter, which enabled it to roll over the roads as well as swim the seas. But even then, granting that the turmoil of Lake Kirdall might be produced by a submarine, brought to a high degree of perfection, there remains as before the question of how could it have reached Lake Kirdall. The lake, shut in on all sides by a circle of mountains, is no more accessible to a submarine than to a sea monster. In whatever way this last puzzling question may be solved, the nature of this strange appearance can no longer be disputed since the 20th of June. On that day, in the afternoon, the schooner Markle, while speeding with all sails set, came into violent collision with something just below the water level. There was no shoal nor rock near, for the lake in this part is 80 or 90 feet deep. The schooner, with both her bow and her side badly broken, ran great danger of sinking. She managed, however, to reach the shore before her decks were completely submerged. When the Markle had been pumped out and hauled up on shore, an examination showed that she had received a blow near the bow as if from a powerful ram. From this it seems evident that there is actually some marine boat which darts about beneath the surface of Lake Kirdall with most remarkable rapidity. The thing is difficult to explain. Not only is there a question as to how did the submarine get there, but why is it there? Why does it never come to the surface? What reason has its owner for remaining unknown? Are other disasters to be expected from its reckless course? The article in the Evening Star closed with this truly striking suggestion. After the mysterious automobile came the mysterious boat. Now comes the mysterious submarine. Must we conclude that the three engines are due to the genius of the same inventor, and that the three vehicles are in truth but one? Chapter 8. At Any Cost. The suggestion of the Star came like a revelation. It was accepted everywhere. Not only were these three vehicles the work of the same inventor, they were the same machine. It was not easy to see how the remarkable transformation could be practically accomplished from one means of locomotion to the other. How could an automobile become a boat, and yet more, a submarine? All the machine seemed to lack was the power of flying through the air. Nevertheless, everything that was known of the three different machines, as to their size, their shape, their lack of odor or of steam, and above all, their remarkable speed, seemed to imply their identity. The public, grown blasé with so many excitements, found in this new marvel a stimulus to reawaken their curiosity. The newspapers dwelt now chiefly on the importance of the invention. This new engine, whether in one vehicle or three, had given proofs of its power. What amazing proofs! The invention must be bought at any price. The United States government must purchase it at once for the use of the nation. Assuredly, the great European powers would stop at nothing to be beforehand with America, and gain possession of an engine so invaluable for military and naval use. What incalculable advantages would it give to any nation, both on land and sea? Its destructive powers could not even be estimated until its qualities and limitations were better known. No amount of money would be too great to pay for the secret. America could not put her millions to better use. But to buy the machine, it was necessary to find the inventor, and there seemed the chief difficulty. In vain was Lake Kirdall searched from end to end. Even its depths were explored with a sounding line without result. Must it be concluded that the submarine no longer lurked beneath its waters? But in that case, how had the boat gotten away? For that matter, how had it come? An insoluble problem. The submarine was heard from no more, neither in Lake Kirdall nor elsewhere. It had disappeared like the automobile from the roads, and like the boat from the shores of America. Several times in my interviews with Mr. Ward, we discussed this matter, which still filled his mind. Our men continued everywhere on the lookout, but as unsuccessfully as other agents. On the morning of the 27th of June, I was summoned into the presence of Mr. Ward. "Well, Strock," said he, "here is a splendid chance for you to get your revenge."
"Revenge for the great Irie disappointment?"
"Of course."
"What chance?" asked I, not knowing if he spoke seriously or in jest.
"Why, here," he answered, "would not you like to discover the inventor of this threefold machine?"
"I certainly would, Mr. Ward. Give me the order to take charge of the matter, and I will accomplish the impossible in order to succeed."
"It is true, I believe it will be difficult."
"Undoubtedly, Strock. Perhaps even more difficult than to penetrate into the Great Eyrie."
It was evident that Mr. Ward was intent on rallying me about my unsuccess. He would not do that, I felt assured, out of mere unkindness. Perhaps then he meant to rouse my resolution. He knew me well, and realized that I would have given anything in the world to recoup my defeat. I waited quietly for new instructions. Mr. Ward dropped his jesting and said to me very generously, "I know, Strock, that you accomplished everything that depended on human powers, and that no blame attaches to you. But we face now a matter very different from that of the Great Eyrie. The day the government decides to force that secret, everything is ready. We have only to spend some thousands of dollars, and the road will be open."
"That is what I would urge."
"But at present," said Mr. Ward, shaking his head, "it is much more important to place our hands on this fantastic inventor, who so constantly escapes us. That is work for a detective, indeed, a master detective."
"He has not been heard from again."
"No, and though there is every reason to believe that he has been, and still continues, beneath the waters of Lake Kirdall, it has been impossible to find any trace of him anywhere around there. One would almost fancy he had the power of making himself invisible, this Proteus of a mechanic."
"It seems likely," said I, "that he will never be seen until he wishes to be."
"True, Strock. And to my mind there is only one way of dealing with him, and that is to offer him such an enormous price that he cannot refuse to sell his invention."
Mr. Ward was right. Indeed, the government had already made the effort to secure speech with this hero of the day, than whom surely no human being has ever better merited the title. The press had widely spread the news, and this extraordinary individual must assuredly know what the government desired of him, and how completely he could name the terms he wished.
"Surely," added Mr. Ward, "this invention can be of no personal use to the man, that he should hide it from the rest of us. There is every reason why he should sell it. Can this unknown be already some dangerous criminal who, thanks to his machine, hopes to defy all pursuit?" My chief then went on to explain that it had been decided to employ other means in search of the inventor. It was possible, after all, that he had perished with his machine in some dangerous maneuver. If so, the ruined vehicle might prove almost as valuable and instructive to the mechanical world as the man himself. But since the accident to the schooner Markle on Lake Kirdall, no news of him whatever had reached the police. On this point, Mr. Ward did not attempt to hide his disappointment and his anxiety. Anxiety, yes, for it was manifestly becoming more and more difficult for him to fulfill his duty of protecting the public.
How could we arrest criminals if they could flee from justice at such speed over both land and sea? How could we pursue them under the oceans? And when dirigible balloons should also have reached their full perfection, we would even have to chase men through the air. I asked myself if my colleagues and I would not find ourselves some day reduced to utter helplessness. If police officials become a useless encumbrance, would be definitely discarded by society. Here, there recurred to me the jesting letter I had received a fortnight before, the letter which threatened my liberty and even my life. I recalled also the singular espionage of which I had been the subject. I asked myself if I had better mention these things to Mr. Ward, but they seemed to have absolutely no relation to the matter now in hand. The great Eyrie affair had been definitely put aside by the government, since an eruption was no longer threatening, and they now wished to employ me upon this newer matter. I waited, then, to mention this letter to my chief at some future time, when it would be not so sore a joke to me. Mr. Ward again took up our conversation. "We are resolved by some means to establish communication with this inventor. He has disappeared, it is true, but he may reappear at any moment, and in any part of the country. I have chosen you, Strock, to follow him the instant he appears. You must hold yourself ready to leave Washington on the moment. Do not quit your house except to come here to headquarters each day. Notify me each time by telephone when you start from home, and report to me personally the moment you arrive here." "I will follow orders exactly, Mr. Ward," I answered. "But permit me one question. Ought I to act alone, or will it not be better to join with me?" "That is what I intend," said the chief, interrupting me. "You are to choose two of our men whom you think the best fitted." "I will do so, Mr. Ward. And now, if some day or other I stand in the presence of our man, what am I to do with him?" "Above all things, do not lose sight of him. If there is no other way, arrest him. You shall have a warrant." "A useful precaution, Mr. Ward. If he started to jump into his automobile and to speed away at the rate we know of, I must stop him at any cost. One cannot argue long with a man making 200 miles an hour. "You must prevent that, Strock. And the arrest made, telegraph me. After that, the matter will be in my hands." "Count on me, Mr. Ward. In any hour, day or night, I shall be ready to start with my men. I thank you for having entrusted this mission to me. If it succeeds, it will be a great honor, and of great profit," added my chief, dismissing me. Returning home, I made all preparations for a trip of indefinite duration. Perhaps my good housekeeper imagined that I planned a return to the Great Eyrie, which she regarded as an antechamber of hell itself. She said nothing, but went about her work with a most despairing face. Nevertheless, sure as I was of her discretion, I told her nothing. In this great mission I would confide in no one. My choice of the two men to accompany me was easily made. They both belonged to my own department, and had many times under my direct command given proofs of their vigor, courage, and intelligence. One, John Hart of Illinois, was a man of 30 years. The other, aged 32, was Nab Walker of Massachusetts. I could not have had better assistance. Several days passed without news, either of the automobile, the boat, or the submarine. There were rumors in plenty, but the police knew them to be false. As to the reckless stories that appeared in the newspapers, they had most of them no foundation whatever. Even the best journals cannot be trusted to refuse an exciting bit of news on the mere ground of its unreliability. Then, twice in quick succession, there came what seemed trustworthy reports of the man of the hour. The first asserted that he had been seen on the roads of Arkansas near Little Rock, the second that he was in the very middle of Lake Superior. Unfortunately, these two notices were absolutely unreconcilable, for while the first gave the afternoon of June 26 as a time of appearance, the second set it for the evening of the same day. Now, these two points of the United States territory are not less than 800 miles apart. Even granting the automobile this unthinkable speed, greater than any it had yet shown, how could it have crossed all the intervening country unseen? How could it traverse the states of Arkansas, Missouri, Iowa, and Wisconsin from end to end without any one of our agents giving us warning, without any interested person rushing to a telephone? After these two momentary appearances, if appearances they were, the machine again dropped out of knowledge. Mr. Ward did not think it worthwhile to dispatch me and my men to either point whence it had been reported. Yet since this marvelous machine seemed still in existence, something must be done. The following official notice was published in every newspaper of the United States under July 3rd. It was couched in the most formal terms. "During the month of April of the present year, An automobile traversed the roads of Pennsylvania, of Kentucky, of Ohio, of Tennessee, of Missouri, of Illinois, and on the 27th of May. And on the 27th of May, during the race held by the American Automobile Club, it covered the course in Wisconsin. Then it disappeared. During the last week of June, a boat maneuvering at great speed appeared off the coast of New England between Cape Cod and Cape Sable, and more particularly around Boston. Then it disappeared. In the second fortnight of the same month, a submarine boat was run beneath the waters of Lake Kirdall in Kansas. Then it disappeared. Everything points to the belief that the same inventor must have built these three machines, or perhaps that they are the same machine, constructed so as to travel both on land and water. A proposition is therefore addressed to the said inventor, whoever he be, with the aim of acquiring the said machine. He is requested to make himself known, and to name the terms upon which he will treat with the United States government. He is also requested to answer as promptly as possible to the Department of Federal Police, Washington, D.C., United States of America. Such was the notice printed in large type on the front page of every newspaper. Surely it could not fail to reach the eye of him for whom it was intended, wherever he might be. He could scarce fail to answer it in some manner. And why should he refuse such an unlimited offer? We had only to await his reply. One can easily imagine how high the public curiosity rose. From morning till night, an eager and noisy crowd pressed about the Bureau of Police, awaiting the arrival of a letter or a telegram. The best reporters were on the spot. What honor, what profit would come to the paper which was first to publish the famous news? To know at last the name and place of the undiscoverable unknown, and to know if he would agree to some bargain with the government. It goes without saying that America does things on a magnificent scale. Millions would not be lacking for the inventor. If necessary, all the millionaires in the country would open their inexhaustible purses. The day passed. To how many excited and impatient people it seemed to contain more than 24 hours. And each hour held far more than 60 minutes. There came no answer, no letter, no telegram. The night following, there was still no news, and it was the same the next day and the next. There came, however, another result, which had been fully foreseen. The cables informed Europe what the United States government had done. The different powers of the old world hoped also to obtain possession of the wonderful invention. Why should they not struggle for an advantage so tremendous? Why should they not enter the contest with their millions? In brief, every great power took part in the affair. France, England, Russia, Italy, Austria, Germany. Only the states of the second order refrained from entering with their smaller resources upon a useless effort. The European press published notices identical with that of the United States. The extraordinary chauffeur had only to speak to become a rival to the Vanderbilts, the Astors, the Goulds, the Morgans, and the Rothschilds of every country of Europe. And, when the mysterious inventor made no sign, what attractive offers were held forth to tempt him to discard the secrecy in which he was enwrapped. The whole world became a public market, an auction house whence arose the most amazing bids. Twice a day the newspapers would add up the amounts, and these kept rising from millions to millions. The end came when the United States Congress, after a memorable session, voted to offer the sum of $20 million. And there was not a citizen of the States, of whatever rank, who objected to the amount, so much importance was attached to the possession of this prodigious engine of locomotion. As for me, I said emphatically to my old housekeeper, the machine is worth even more than that. Evidently, the other nations of the world did not think so, for their bids remained below the final sum. But how useless was this mighty struggle of the great rivals! The inventor did not appear. He did not exist. He had never existed. It was all a monstrous pretense of the American newspapers. That, at least, became the announced view of the old world. And so the time passed. There was no further news of our man. There was no response from him. He appeared no more. For my part, not knowing what to think, I commenced to lose all hope of reaching any solution to the strange affair. Then on the morning of the 15th of July, a letter without postmark was found in the mailbox of the police bureau. After the authorities had studied it, it was given out to the Washington journals, which published it in facsimile in special numbers. It was couched as follows. Chapter 9. The Second Letter. On Board the Terror, July 15th. To the Old and New World. the propositions emanating from the different governments of Europe, as also that which has finally been made by the United States of America, need expect no other answer than this. I refuse absolutely and definitely the sums offered for my invention. My machine will be neither French, nor German, nor Austrian, nor Russian, nor English, nor American. The invention will remain my own, and I shall use it as pleases me. With it, I hold control of the entire world, and there lies no force within the reach of humanity which is able to resist me, under any circumstances whatsoever. Let no one attempt to seize or stop me. It is, and will be, utterly impossible. Whatever injury anyone attempts against me, I will return 100-fold. As to the money which is offered me, I despise it. I have no need of it. Moreover, on the day when it pleases me to have millions or billions, I have but to reach out my hand and take them. Let both the old and the new world realize this. They can accomplish nothing against me. I can accomplish anything against them. I sign this letter, the Master of the World. Thus concludes the Public Domain Podcast of The Master of the World, Part 4, which was Chapters 7, 8, and 9. Tune in next week for the continuation of the novel, and check in at the website, which is at publicdomainpodcast.blogspot.com. Feel free to leave any comments or suggestions there, or if you'd like to give me direct feedback, I could be reached at publicdomainpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.